listening to the Bi Sci-Fi Podcast. I'm your host, Carrie Pack, and this is your home for queer positive speculative fiction. My guest for this episode is Gail Carriger, author of The Fifth Gender, which is from the Tinkered Stars universe. And I'm so excited to have you here, Gail. Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure, and I'm super excited.
Yay. I love people who love podcasting. We were talking a little bit before we hit the record button, and you apparently are a pro podcaster, so no pressure. tell us a little bit about The Fifth Gender and kind of what we can expect in the overall universe.
So I come to fiction writing, I suppose, in general from sci-fi fantasy, but most of the stuff that I've written up until now has been either steampunk or urban fantasy in setting. But I've always loved science fiction. So I basically was like, I really want to write a sci-fi set book. And it's been kind of percolating in the back of my head. And then Triss, the crazy, queer, alien, purple, tentacle-haired character just bopped into my head. And for some reason, my brain was like, we are going to make this a cozy mystery on a space station. And the love interest is going to be this grumpy, you know, cop-type character. And it just took off from there.
That sounds amazing. A cozy mystery on a space station.
Yes, with an alien from a race with five different genders. Yes.
I love this. I'm an author myself, but I feel like everyone else always has such better, like, crazy off the wall ideas, and crazy off the wall in a good way. I don't mean that as an insult, but like,
it's not necessarily a good thing. How do I sell something with so many different genres in it? And like, what are people going to think? And it's also super sexy. So I was just like, I like to joke that people turn to me and say, Gail, put down the trope. And I'm like, no, I must collect them all.
Yes, in one book.
In one book, yeah.
But I love that. I mean, tropes are what draw, like, you know, sometimes you can sell people on a trope. Like, I was at a con once and a writer friend of mine, they have a series, a duology that's soulmate, like the whole clock in your fingernail kind of thing. And, you know, if you've ever read any fan fiction, they're all that. And or at least they were for a period of time. And, you know, you'd say that to people and their eyes would just get huge and they're like, oh, I love that trope. And, you know, it's like easiest sell in the world.
Yeah, I was thinking about this recently. Actually, I did a couple of blog posts about my reading wheelhouses. I listened to another podcast that's called Reading Glasses, and they have this reading wheelhouse thing, which is basically what tropes you're really attracted to and you really look for. And so I did a couple of blog posts that are like, here's the things that really turn me off as a reader, and here's the things that I'm really hungry for. And that doesn't necessarily mean that I write all of those things. But one of mine is anytime a girl cross-dresses as a boy in order to subvert the patriarchy, I am like, I will read that thing. Like, that is all you need to say, and I will pick it up and read it.
Yeah, I'm excited to see, you know, someone had said they wanted me to write something like that, like basically redo The Twelfth Night, you know, and do like a space opera version of it. And I was like, that would be really great, except for I think the where we are and now as a queer culture, I think that's a story that I think a trans person needs to write.
Yes.
Like, I think that that's a story that when we talk about gender identity and how that, I think that would be a really great story to hear about, you know, a person assigned like female at birth, dressing as a man to, you know, for an adventure purpose or for,
yes,
to basically get by, and then discovering that, oh wow, this is me. That this isn't a disguise anymore. This is who I am. I think that would be, I mean, I would love to read it, but I don't think it's my story to tell. But I think that that could be a really powerful story for a trans author to write.
And I want to say that I've heard something about something like that, and that in the 1990s, there's a series called the Mage Wars series, one of which the books is Star Pilot's Grave. Another one is The Price of the Stars. And it features a woman named Becca who cross-dresses as a male pirate in a space opera political setting. So it has been done. It is actually an excellent series. It's a co-authored series. And they portray her as almost like double identity. Like she almost turns into a man half the time in a kind of incredibly gender fluid way, which is really interesting from you know, a mainstream publisher series from the 90s, I recommend taking a look at it and reading it. It's fascinating how it's handled in the books.
What was the name of that one again?
The name of the series is The Mage Wars.
Okay.
And I think the first one is The Price of the Stars. I think that's the name of the first one. It's fascinating. It's kind of it's a space opera, but it also has sort of magical-ish elements to it, so.
I love, too, when we can look back on fiction from decades past and kind of put a contemporary lens on it, too, and see it through that and be like, wow, people were telling these stories and we didn't have words maybe necessarily mm-hmm. for them in the mainstream, and to say, oh, that sounds like a non-binary or a gender-fluid character, mm-hmm. and that you can find representation that's been there. And it's funny that publishers were less scared of it before it had a label.
I believe in looking at it through a certain amount of like retrospective analysis, because they did not have the language or really the contact with own voices yet. And
right.
So there are some mistakes in those, in those books, unfortunately, but it's also interesting from my perspective, from like a point of relevance as forming this generation's or the next generation's of author voices. So, you know, those are my formative history as a writer, or books from like the 90s. And so queer representation in those books is kind of what I had to draw from. And so I think about them a lot as a kind of point of my heritage, almost more than anything else in a queer realm.
Yeah, it's the like traipsing through the desert, thirsty. Mm-hmm. Oh, look!
Look.
Well, and I think I've talked before on the podcast about the need for my personal need for a label, and not being able to find that because there were no labels in the fiction or the television or the movies that I was consuming, and that there were representations of those things, but of people like me, but they were always shown as confused or promiscuous, or I mean, mm-hmm. we talk about this all the time with bisexuality, but like those are the things that we were shown in the 90s, and the bisexual characters were flaky. I mean, look at look at Rent,
or untrustworthy,
right.
In certain cases as well, because it's just that a bisexual person hasn't made up their mind yet.
Oh, they don't like labels. So mm-hmm. like, you know how helpful like that label would have been to me at like 13, 14 years old to like see someone who, you know, reflects kind of that, I'm not gay, but I'm not straight. I don't know. And going through that.
Yeah.
Awkwardness of that, and I don't know.
It's why, for me at least, when even if they do get it wrong, or when they get it spectacularly right, like they did on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, that like I'm just excited when a character that has any touchstone for me is like honestly represented as a well-rounded individual on a sitcom. Mm-hmm. Like I'm just like, thank heavens, you know, or dramedy or whatever, even if, you know, something like Bones, but. Like I just get, I'm like, oh hey, look, yay! and it's not necessarily that I think that character has to be representative of all bisexuality or all pansexuality or what have you. It's just that it's nice that there's a model out there mm-hmm. for young people to look at and be like, oh maybe, and I should start thinking about that, in access in a way that I didn't have at all, except in genre fiction when I was a kid. Like that was the only place I saw in pop culture I saw any kind of representation.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah, yeah. I one of the I think probably for I've noticed for a lot of queer folk, especially ones that identified themselves as such later in life, that that speculative fiction in general had a really powerful meaning for them, because there was basically the only place you could find that, especially in the 80s and 90s. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I look back at, I've rewatched Star Trek, The Next Generation, recently.
Oh
like
my gosh. Did you watch the what is it, the Trill episode? Or there's mm-hmm. a Riker on the homosexual planet episode.
Mm-hmm. There's so much in that about gender expression and gender identity and sexuality. And they talked about it and explored it in a way that would I'm going to say appeal because it doesn't need to, but like be comfortable for mainstream audiences, but also really be subversive for queer people who already knew and could look at it and be like, yes, that's my community. Like, this is where we're going. And to say, here's, you know, 100 or so years in the future, and this is where we'll be. I mean, that was such a, and then you look at all of the things that came about as a result of that. I mean, you look at, especially Next Generation, iPads,
yes.
And you look at, you know, like the tricorder, and it's like basically a smartphone, you know, and all of
yes.
these things that came out of a result of the Star Trek series. That, so I have to hold out hope that the progressiveness of what they experienced and how open, you know, the crew always was to these new civilizations is going to be how we start to accept each other. But
yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and it did have its problems, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things that struck me, I was a huge Next Gen Trekkie as a teen, and one of the things that struck me profoundly as somebody who went to, like, Star Trek conventions and stuff like that was listening to Deanna Troi talk about the fact that her character didn't actually get a brain or have anything particularly useful to do until they took her out of dresses and put her in a pantsuit, just like all the other characters.
Right.
And, like, I'm a very aesthetic person. I'm very interested in clothing. I'm very interested in how what you wear can manipulate people's perceptions of you. And I mean, objects and clothing and apparel come into all of my books in some way or another. That might have been part of it, was just as like a little 14-year-old hearing her talk about that and being like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize it. But there, you know, there were like underpinning discussions and arguments that were going on perhaps on the set and, you know, about representation and things like that, which we don't even know about
right.
as viewers.
Well, and also it's important too as a representation of that it's hard for us to overcome the stuff that's ingrained in us from our life in society. I mean, you're not immune to the prejudices of those around you just because you logically know that they're wrong. It doesn't mean that you still don't reflect them or express them in ways. And you know, that's unfortunate. But, you know, even a very progressive writer could be writing for this and being like, oh, well, she's a woman, and subconsciously kind of like, oh, she's wearing a dress, she can't do this.
Yes.
But at the same time. So do you know the origins of the expression gird your loins?
No.
So the expression of gird your loins, now I've read this on the internet, so it could be totally wrong, but even if it isn't, I'm going to go with it because it's awesome.
Okay.
So the idea was, you know, of course, you know, you look at clothing prior to men's clothing prior to probably what the 1700s, men still would wear doublets and things that would get in the way in combat, especially look like the ancient Romans were wearing, you know, like togas and these like, I don't know what they called them, the like leather skirty things or whatever, you know. And so the idea of girding your loins was literally taking that extra fabric and kind of pulling it up between your legs and like tucking it into your belt so that you would be prepared for battle. You would be literally girding your loins. You'd be taking all that extra fabric and tucking it in so you could move better. And I'm like, somebody needs to write that into their fantasy for a woman. Like, she's girding her loins. She's literally like taking all this fabric. And I mean, it's been written that way, but just using the literal term, like, I just think that'd be awesome. But
that would be awesome.
But yeah, so it's you can fight in a skirt. It's been done by men.
It's true.
Because you know, we all have to prove that a man can do it that way before a woman can do it that way.
Yes. Yeah. It's rough. And it's back to your idea about like how our own prejudice come through, especially as writers. One of the side effects I'm encountering is also because there are so many different presentations of sexuality and gender now, is that it's hard for me to write it all. I don't know how other, like I often get fans who will write to me and be like, where are your ace characters? Or where are your like female to male trans characters or what have you? And I'm just, and I'm like, I can't, I'm not playing Pokemon. I can only write as fast as I can write. And I try to be broad spectrum in my representation. But that's just something I've been facing up to recently where I'm like, there comes a point where I turn it around and I'm like, you should write a thing. Like, everyone should write the thing. Because
I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, I'm all for the intersectionality of including everyone, right? And having allowing people to be more than one thing as a character. And but at the same time, if you're not if it's not a known voices story for you, if it's not, you know, you're writing an ace character and that's not you,
yeah,
that's certainly a lot more research. And not to say that it's like, oh, I can't do all that research. But again, if I'm not going to do, I'm not going to be able to do the research in the way that I want to, or do the, you know, the work in that, it could do more harm than good for me to put the character in there and then it not be right.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, I have to say, I struggle with Ace the most, I think, because I writer empathy is a thing, and sometimes you can put yourself into other people's shoes and sometimes you can't. And I'm such, as a person, I'm such a sexual person, and I am what would be Pan. I just identify as bi because that was the first moniker I got. I literally tend to look at people as sexual objects first, mm-hmm. and then everything else after that. and not that I necessarily want to jump into bed with everybody. It's just that that's like the perspective I come from. It's one of the reasons I write super sexy stuff, is I'm like, I really love sex and I'm into it and I'm into talking about it and writing about it and showing it. And so Ace is particularly difficult for me to understand. And so I'm like, I really like, but what I've done is tried to kind of read more widely so that other people's, whether their own voices or not, but also own voices, representations of Ace on the page, I can be like, look, I really enjoyed this book. It has a happy ending. It has things that I look for. And it also happens to have an Ace main character. That kind of thing is kind of where I've gone instead. I'm like, I don't necessarily catch all of the Pokemon, but I will try to read all of the Pokemon so that I can recommend them to everybody.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the best we can do. I mean, it's not reasonable, I don't think, to say every single author should write every single, you know, marginalized group ever to exist. I mean, that's not possible, and to do it well, you know? I mean, I don't think, and I think this, there's some times in the past where I've attempted to include marginalized characters and didn't do the best I could because of my own shortcomings in knowledge, even, you know?
And
you know, it's like, I'm torn on whether I want to continue to contribute to what I think we all know is the problem of publishing, which is that it's just too much of the same. Mm-hmm. Or if I want to try and fail miserably, maybe, you know. And that's not to say I would, but it's a hard decision to make. And it's when you're sitting there and you're writing and these characters are talking to you and you think you know who they are and they reveal something to you, and then you have to rethink. You know,
yeah,
I had a character in a novella revealed to me very close to end of writing it that he was Ace, and I just like, I have nothing to say about it because he's not the main character, but I know that this is who he is, and do I say it or not? And I said it, and I don't know that I really, that was the right choice. I don't know, but he's there, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting. I've brought this up recently quite a bit. We were talking before we started about the fact that I just came back from Denver Comic Con, and it is also the beginning of Pride. And so, you know, there's these kinds of discussions were going on quite a bit, as they should. Although I have to say, having grown up in fandom, that it is a joy to see not only the presence of queer folk, but also the conversations and panels and all those sorts of things, which, you know, it's been 25 years in the making. Where was I going with this? One of the things I was saying is that for writers, I remember an early podcaster who used to say that one should move, and he was talking about life, but one should move in the direction of greatest courage. And I always think that as writers, there's always a part of our brain that is just terrified to take the risk, because yeah. We live in an age where you will be publicly and brutally called out. But on the other hand, like, how else do we strive to improve and change ourselves? Not just as in technique, in the style of writing, but in, you know, the power of emotion that our words can cause when they go out into the universe and touch strangers. And the only way to do that is to some extent to take risks. And that includes writing, you know, other voices that are not your own and might terrify you. But then again, that's a really huge risk to take. So, you know, you're always weighing those, or I am often weighing those consequences when I'm writing new books.
I mean, I'm not afraid of the public backlash. I just, because I do feel like,
I mean, I am
to an extent. Like, you never want to be called out, but I'm not afraid of it in the sense of if it does happen. And I have had thankfully it was not done publicly, but I did have a reviewer come back and be like, "This is really offensive. I won't review your book." And it was literally a phrase, and it was something that I did not, as a white person, did not know that this was offensive to a biracial person, and I took it out. I said to this person immediately, oh my gosh, I am horrified that I did this. I did not know. I'm going to contact my publisher immediately and see if I can get it taken out before the final version, because this is just the arc. And I said, I'm going to see if I can make that happen, and I'll let you know what comes of it. And both I and my publisher contacted the reviewer and said, here's what we're doing. We're taking it out. We apologize. The reviewer was so gracious considering, and basically said, great, awesome, great response. I won't say anything about it publicly, but I'm not going to review the book. Yeah. And that's fine. The harm was done. I felt truly, truly awful, you know, but I think where people fall short is defending themselves and basically like doubling down on poor choices. And when all you need to say is, oh my gosh, I am so terribly sorry. I did not know. I will do better next time, and I'll do what I can now to rectify this if I can.
Yeah.
Because that's all we can do as human beings. We can't, we can't rewind time, although I wish I could sometimes. we can't.
And also, it's if you're putting something that, you know, your art out into the universe, that is also a struggle, right? Like, you're putting it out into for large numbers of people to consume. And the other side of that equation, if somebody comes to your books and wants to take offense with them, then there's not a whole lot you can do about that either. If they're just, there's a chip on the shoulder and they're for example, I had some early flack writing queer characters because I present extremely femmy. I always have. And I'm very private about my partners because they didn't ask to be conjoined to a public persona. Right. And so I'm very careful about even insofar as using gender with them. And so people just assumed that I was straight, and I was like, I'm not. and so they came to my books about queer characters assuming that I was not, to a certain extent, on Voices. And so, you know, eventually I was just like, okay, I will come to this delicately and do things like interview on the Bi Sci-Fi podcast, because it seems clear that people need to know that about me. And there was a part of me, because I do come, you know, I come from the 90s. There was a part of me that's like, it's nobody's business but my own occupies my bed.
That's still true. That's not, that's, you don't owe your readers anything, or my listeners for that matter. I welcome my thing with this podcast has always been, if you idea is queer or you've written queer characters as, you know, and they are the main characters in your book, you're welcome on this podcast. I don't require that people write own voices, although I do try to uplift those books and those authors as much as I possibly can. But, you know, at the end of the day, we need to stop policing each other about our sexuality and our gender, because it's nobody's friggin' business if you don't want to come out publicly. Even if you're out to everyone you know, maybe you don't want to be out under your pen name, or you're using your real name. You don't want to be out, you know? And that's okay. I think the problem is there's been situations in the book community where people have gotten burned. And if we go back and look at, I don't know if you're familiar with the whole Santino Hassel thing.
But oh, yes. Where people, intimately. Right. Well, not intimately, but very, because that is one of the genres that I read and enjoy very much, is male-male.
Yeah.
And I actually have read and enjoyed several of Santino's books and really, really liked them. And so when that happened, I was like, oh.
And that author team or whatever was very talented. But they also lied to the community in order to sell more books, is what ultimately it came down to. I mean, that was a strategy to sell more books. And people had uplifted that author at the expense of other. I mean, I have a friend who, now granted, doesn't write the same kind of stuff, but does write MM. And he is a gay man. I've met him in real life. I've met his partner. I know him personally. I have stayed at his house. He has stayed at mine. We are good friends. And, you know, constantly Santino would get recommended as a own voices you know, gay author.
Yeah.
And my friend never did. Now, granted, there's a whole other bevy of reasons why that wouldn't happen, but I'm saying that as that wasn't just my friend that was happening to.
No, you know, I agree.
That is every gay man who legitimately is an author that isn't as successful as Santino Hassel was, that is what happened. And that's sad. So but again, can't police each other. Like, fraud is fraud, but also what's in someone else's pants or in their bed is not your business.
Yeah. I have gone to the point now as frankly, more and more queer folk are on panels with me, and also, you know, as I meet more people in person and read their books and enjoy them and stuff like that, of saying, you know, like, this person is on Vices, I know that. But, like, I can't speak to all of these other books that I'm recommending, but if they are open and out about it and clearly, you know, want that to be part of their brand and their message as authors, then I will make point of saying that. If, like, for example, I was on a young adult, queer fiction and young adult fiction panel near here with CB Lee, who is fantastic.
She's so awesome. I love
she's
her.
So awesome, and it's very open about the fact that she's bi. Mm-hmm. And she's also Asian, or at least part Asian, and she obviously is open about that. She puts that into her books and into her characters very frequently. And so, you know, like, I was like, okay, we've had a cool conversation. I know that you're out about this because we were on a panel about mm-hmm. this kind of yeah. thing together. So, like, when I talk about what, you know, queer and YA, and her books are also really great, I will recommend them as kind of a strong voice in the field, as an own voice, you know, because she has essentially, at least I think, given me tacit permission to do that.
She's one of my friends and a publisher sibling, so I love her.
We
had the same first name. Yeah, no, she's actually she is Asian. She is Vietnamese and Chinese.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. She's the same rep as Jess and Not Your Sidekick. And it was funny, we were in a hotel room at a convention, a whole bunch of us from our publisher were doing a write-in, and she's like, I just don't know if I should make this character like straight Vietnamese or if I should make her Vietnamese and Chinese like me, and I just don't know if that's weird or not. And I'm like, girl, if she's like you, make her like you. Like, what? The whole group is like, yeah. So I was, you know, we were like, yes, do the own voices thing. So, you know, full on, just the same kind of thing. But yeah, she is genuinely, we always joke, we went to Dragon Con with her one year, shared a room with her, Taylor Brooke, and F.T. Lukens. And so the four of us are all in a room together, and we were talking about our Hogwarts houses, and CB Lee is a Hufflepuff, and she is a Hufflepuff through and through. Because did she give you snacks? Because she always has snacks on her. All the time.
I tweeted this recently. I was like, because I get a lot of followers and I don't automatically follow back. And there are certain things that are like red markers for like, I'm never going to follow you back. But one of the things I realized recently is if somebody has Hufflepuff listed as their house, I will immediately follow them back. It is right. Like the best, like, oh, that person's going to be cool on the internet signal. And I was like, man, if the scammers and the bots figure that out, I'm in trouble, because all I need to do is see Hufflepuff and I'm like,
that's it.
And to me,
the first time I met her, we were at a convention and we're sitting on some early morning panel and we're all just sitting there, and she literally pulls a breakfast burrito out of her bag, like a homemade one, like not like she went to McDonald's or like Del Taco or something. She like legitimately pulled out this like breakfast burrito and was just like chomping on it, and I'm like, you are awesome. And then every time I've ever been in a con with her, she's like, one time I was like, oh gosh, I think my blood sugar is like really dropping, I haven't eaten all day, and she's like, you want a granola bar, you want an apple, you want a banana, just like pulling all this stuff out. And I'm like, you were such the mom. But it's so we joked that she's just like the epitome of Hufflepuff and just the nicest, kindest, supportive person. Like, I have never, I'm a Slytherin, I am not the kindest person, and so I admire truly people who are genuinely just open-hearted, good people. Yeah.
I have a bit in one of my books where the main character is pregnant and she's surrounded by a werewolf pack, and who are kind of looking after her and freaking out because they don't know how to handle this. And they all start like staging snacks all over their bodies because they never know what she's going to be craving at any given time. And so they all start sort of crinkling as they walk. And now I'm imagining CB Lee like crinkling as she walks through. Like, can I get you a granola bar? Here you go.
Well, and you know, I think it's probably the impression that I got from her too, is that just started out as like a thing to save money when you're at a con, because otherwise you spend hundreds a day eating out, you know, and it's so smart. Like, it's so freaking smart. You know, it's like, she's like, I got peanut butter jelly. Anybody want a sandwich?
Yeah, I'm one of the other things I do is I do a travel podcast, and the slogan for that podcast is Pack the Snacks, because my friend Piper and I, we're both like who host the podcast. We're always talking about, like, we have all of these codes for traveling, and one of my codes is the burrito protocol. I almost always travel with a burrito just because it's like nature's perfect confined high protein snack on the go.
So you need to have like a special episode where you bring CB on and you're like, listen, why don't you do a thing for us about packing for a con.
Let us talk about snacks at conventions.
She puts it in her luggage. I just love it. I just absolutely, like, I would never think to, I don't know why I would never think to do that. I am so cheap and I love to eat. So I don't know why I would never think of that. It's because I'm a Slytherin and not a Hufflepuff. So you were telling me too that you have another book coming out in August. What can you tell us about your next title?
So just in case anybody's new to me, The Fifth Gender, which we've already talked about, which is the crazy queer sci-fi and space alien five genders from an alien race with no word for murder and a murderer aboard their spaceship, which then the humans, of course, have to figure out, because humans know all about murder. So they come to the humans for help. That is under the G.L. Carriger. So I have two pen names. I have Gail Carriger and G.L. Carriger, and that's just a high heat level distinction. So the G.L. books have a lot more sex in them, basically.
Noted.
And that's, I know. And that's because I also write young adult and under the Gail moniker, and I just wanted it to be, you know, relatively clear. So The Fifth Gender is under G.L. Carriger, and then my next book that's out after that in August is under Gail Carriger, and it's the fourth book in a series and the final book in a series. Is called Reticence. I just read the Publisher's Weekly review, and they said that you could probably read it as a standalone, but you probably will get more out of it if you've read the other books in the series. It's traditionally published from a larger house, and I finally managed them to let me put a lesbian main character in the third book of that series. So the book immediately preceding this has lesbian main characters, but because they are also like straight, they're steampunk, but they're like adventure, fantasy, sci-fi, steampunk kind of thing. So there do tend to be romances in my books, and they almost always have happy endings because that's what I look for. But they're not going to be the primary driver in those books. But there's a ton of queer characters in those books. It's essentially about a sort of dirigible crew full of misfits dashing around the crumbling British Empire and finding new supernatural creatures and rescuing tea plantations and things like that. So,
that sounds right up my alley. Not gonna lie.
I write very silly and ridiculous stuff. So my whole perspective as a writer is that all I want is to leave people grinning. So I like to describe my books as book hugs. They're just like, everything will be okay. I don't write graphic violence. I rarely have anything that will trigger anybody in my stuff, except for graphic sex and some of it. But yeah, I really like a huge theme of found family that just threads through everything I write. That's super important to me, probably because I come from the queer community. So this book is the fourth one in that series, which is called the Custard Protocol series, and it's called Reticence. And in it, the characters are off to Japan to uncover the possible existence of Kitsune, or Kitsune. So
nice.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm just like, you know, I always say I'm always like, ooh, that sounds good. That sounds good. I think starting a podcast was bad for my TBR
reading
pile.
List.
Yes.
So
it's
become a writer, quite frankly, because as soon as you become a writer, everybody's like, oh, I loved your book. Have you read this book?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no.
And you should be widely read in your genre and you know, you should read your peers and things like that. Just to also, so you don't accidentally copy somebody, but also to kind of know where what the other books are out there. So then people ask you questions like the one I'm about to ask you, you have answers for them. So what have you been reading lately that you're really stoked about?
So like I said before, I am a huge fan of male-male romance in particular, or gay romance. And I recently read, which as of this recording is relatively recently out, which makes me feel good because I'm usually not on top of things like that.
Same.
Earth Fathers are weird, which really kind of is a great companion, I feel like, to Fifth Gender. It is by Lynn Galla, and the premise is that a human male is accidentally kidnapped by aliens, who are then terribly embarrassed about this, and dump him on a worker planet where he has to try and get a job in order to get home to Earth, which hasn't really had first contact yet. And so this human thinks he is taking a job as a nanny for a squiddy sort of tentacled alien, and it turns out he's in fact taking a job as a surrogate. And hijinks ensue. It is like there is one delicate Pantai-esque sex scene near the end, but it is mostly about found family and the most adorable, like, little alien children ever, little squiddy aliens. And it's just totally charming and like right up my alley. So that's Lynn Galla, which is Earth Fathers Are Weird, who also has another like great queer sci-fi with a slight BDSM element series called the Claimings series, which touches on another thing that is in my wheelhouse, which is culture conflict. It's one of my favorite things to read ever, whether in fantasy or sci-fi. So Lynn Galla, check her out. I consider her kind of like the pinnacle of gay romance in space. I think she's just really good. I think it's just that she gets the sci-fi element and the world building as much as the romance element, so that it's a real even balance. And the relationships between the human, it's always, hers are always humans and aliens.
Yeah.
And the relationships and the, like, she's very into linguistics and, you know, how you speak and negotiate and communicate between an alien and a human. And I just love it. So, so Earth Fathers Are Weird is the book that I'm shouting out right now.
Awesome.
I think it's cute.
So what are you working on now? Do you have anything that you want to tell us about? Yeah. Any works in progress? I'm doing like the little, you can't see this, but I'm doing the like Mr. Burns, like finger steepling right now. I'm like, doo-hoo-hoo.
Anyway, this is a big thing to unpack, because what I'm actually working on right now is nonfiction, which I've never written before.
Cool.
And it is the heroine's journey for writers. A lot of people know about the hero's journey. What a lot of people don't know is that there is also a heroine's journey, and it's very different, and it is used just as frequently, but it is like rarely critically analyzed. It's never talked about. Like, if I asked most writers to name the narrative beats of the hero's journey, they probably wouldn't have too much of an issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
If I asked them to name the heroines, they would give me a blank look. And I just got really, really tired of those blank looks. So I have a minor in classics. So I was basically like, look, I've been waiting for someone else to write this book, and nobody is. And this is exactly what happened with Solace, which was my first book and which was a bit of a breakout for me. So I was basically like, okay, this is the nonfiction version of that. It is a hole that I really need to fill. And I'm nervous about it because I'm not an academic, you know, like I don't have a PhD in the subject or anything, but I am a writer and I do have a lot of, you know, New York Times bestselling, you know, and a million book print and stuff like that. So I was like, I have some voice of authority for this, and I'm just desperate to have something to give to people. So,
well, as someone who has to choose from a bunch of PhD written textbooks to teach her classes, I'm going to tell you that that is overrated, and that if you can express an idea clearly and concisely, you're 100 miles ahead of most PhDs.
Yeah, I am using kind of the technique I'm known for, which is to take a setting that's probably kind of dry, like the Victorian era, for example, and writing it in a kind of breezy manner that I hope makes it accessible to a wider audience. And I'm doing exactly that same technique with this nonfiction book. I mean, there are certainly passages where I have to get dry in order to be precise enough, but most of it is, and it is also designed so that you can skip around and take the pieces that you need. Like, if you need the three myths as a basis, and then you want to jump to just like the breakdown of the beats as a writer, I'm writing it in such a way that you can do that. Like, you can scan and pick up.
Awesome.
And pick chapters and stuff like that. But it should be, hopefully, quite conversational and readable to a broad audience. I am writing it for, you know, kind of my fellow writers and readers.
Yeah.
The idea is also so that you can go out into the world and start to recognize these things when they show up on your screen, or in a book. Like it's like my tag for this is like, you will never look at pop culture the same way again after you know this, that there's a second narrative out there that we've been neglecting for 800 years.
for real. Well, thank you so much for coming on. If my listeners wanted to get in touch with you online, are you on Twitter, Facebook? Where's the best place to connect with you?
Honestly, I am on all the things, so you can just Google my name and then whichever platform is your preference, but I do use them slightly differently. So like on Twitter, if you are a writer, I am more likely to kind of talk about writerly things on Twitter because that's where all the writers hang out. Whereas on Facebook, I'm a little bit more there for my reader base because they tend to be more on Facebook. And on, and of course, on Tumblr is the only place that I am kind of like all queer all the time. So it's kind of like what you want for me and where you are comfortable hanging out. But I'm pretty much everywhere. But you can go to my website. There's a contact page that has all of the links to all my different platforms.
Awesome. And I'll make sure to link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, and also if you're looking for like other reader recommendations, because Fifth Gender came out, I have a bunch of blog posts with like there's, I have a further fiction reading for gender fluidity and various like varied sexual identities that's live recently, so that's out there. I'll send Carrie the link, and if she wants to, she can have that in the show notes or
certainly.
What have you.
I'm happy to throw anything in there. You know, it's like if anybody wants resources, here they are.
Yes. I also have a big like resources page on researching gender fluidity and stuff like that because awesome. I had to do that, and I am not own voices in that particular arena. So, so kind of I will give you an example of what I went through in order to write the Fifth Gender, kind of knowing that it didn't exactly represent me.
Right.
So you can take a look at that kind of thing from an author perspective if you like.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. And I'm really looking forward to your book on craft. I mean, I think anytime that it feels like anytime an author does something like that, they're giving back. So I think that's really great. And
thank you. It is talk about a thing I'm really scared of doing and a huge risk. It does kind of feel like giving back too. And I hope more than anything else, it just like encourages academics to start looking into this and talking about it, but also laymen to write about it. Like, I think once people get into this, maybe we'll get a screenwriter version of this kind of narrative. And so thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, no problem. Well, again, thank you so much for being on and stay in touch.
Thank you too.
You've been listening to the Buy Sci-Fi Podcast. Find us online at buysci-fipodcast.wordpress.com and on Twitter at buysci-fi.